Bon dia y buenos días, gente. Welcome to Eco Village Library. This is a podcast to look for expanding your own consciousness and skills and knowledge of all things required to live a better life, living for oneself, and just exploring the world, man. For today's episode, I have a book I want to review that's called How to Read Water by Tristan Gooley. And what does that mean, to read water? Water from the seas or the lake, rain, puddles, basically all of it. As anthropologist Lauren Aisley said, if there is magic on this planet, it is contained in water. Because you know, when you think about it, there's signs all around us that tells many different stories. It's just a matter of listening, engaging all the senses, and putting together the puzzles to sense what's going on. And one thing I realized reading this book was that a lot of people from our history, and also, you know, current days too, but not as much, but definitely a lot of people written about, even not written about in history, knew a lot about how to get around on this planet without using maps, without using pretty much anything. For example, I don't know if you're familiar with the term songline, but this is usually what some indigenous peoples from, you know, Australia, for example, would sing to themselves as a way of navigation, to navigate themselves around a deserted land where, you know, to the modern eye, it all just kind of looks the same. But to these people, you know, they've mapped it out in songs and words, and their senses were so much more engaged than ours. So this book is an example, or just a collection of examples of this ancestral wisdom, and it was fascinating. So this episode, I just want to share some of that with you. And a little bit about the author too. This guy definitely walks his talk. He's, you know, it says here that he's the only person to have navigated solo across the Atlantic, sailing, that is, sailing solo across the Atlantic. And let's see what else, navigating with the Omani tribes people, canoeing in Borneo. And well, it also says just walking in his own backyard. So you don't have to go through extravagant places to prove that you could navigate the world. It all starts just in your own backyard, kind of engaging your senses and see what's going on. The key is observation. You know, it's one of the fundamental principles of permaculture. That is to observe and interact in for extended periods of time, which may be very uncomfortable for the vast majority of us modern folk. And it's, you know, one thing to get knowledge quickly from an online Google search or through my voice, through this podcast, through a book. But the best is always from the source. Kind of like what I remember my grandma once saying with vitamins. You could take the vitamins, it'll, you know, nourish you, but it's not the same as from the source. And it's kind of the same with this ancestral wisdom. It's best to learn from nature, with nature, as you are in the middle of nature or whatever your circumstance is. But the second best is books and other resources. Not saying it's useless. It's definitely useful. But yeah, you know, if you want to learn about how to sail the seas, but you're, you know, Denver, for example, in a landlocked state, miles away from the nearest coastline, well, you could start by books. Books are always, it's kind of like the vitamins of wisdom, I or of knowledge, I like to think of it. So that being said, this book of How to Read Water is a fortifying vitamin. Oh, just made me feel great. I learned a lot. And I hope you get something out of this too. Well, I'll begin, you know, by saying what I liked about the book. Like for one thing, he used a lot of historical examples, like I said, and man, God, I like to share a story. One of my favorite stories from this is just a quick, you know, short story of an example of a navigator. His name is Captain Abhara from Persia, but we'll get to that later. That'll be the dessert to end the show. So I'm pretty much just going to lay out all the gems onto the table, you know, the gems that I've extracted from this book, that is, and just kind of spit fire through all of them. And, you know, what am I talking about with these gems? Like, for example, let's say it rained and you see a, you know, big old rainbow, but, you know, just looks, it's just a regular old rainbow the way you see it. But the colors would tell you a lot about the raindrops. For example, with a rainbow of a bigger red color, that signifies more bigger raindrops. So all of a sudden, rainbows just got a whole lot more interesting, didn't it? And it's great with these observations because it's not only just for the analytical mind, but also for the poetic mind as well. Whatever way you're steering or you mix the two, kind of like the Aborigines with the song lines, mixing the poetic with the analytical. And also these gems of knowledge could serve as a convenience as well. For example, if I'm coming across an area and I'm, you know, inspecting a land of some sort, I just really want to know if it floods here quite often, you know, without having to go and sit in front of a computer and looking up flood maps or investigating old documents and kind of like, you know, going through all this analytical research, you know, instead of doing all that, I could just save myself time if I knew what I was looking for. For example, looking for plants of which could give you clues or basically dead away clues, whether it's a floodplain or not. But also note too, it's just not that simple as also what might look like flooding site around a river, for example, devoid of scrub. It could be a floodplain or it could just be an area that was recently grazed. So you got to kind of pay quite attention. Well, one thing certain in this case is that reed canary grass prefers areas that alternate between wet and dry. So this could be more of a giveaway of a flood area. Now you're standing on the bank of the river and, well, you're dying of thirst and just want to stick your head in that river and just drink all there is. But wait, you see that there's a bit of a foam there. And, you know, foam could be natural. And, well, when I mean natural, I mean, you know, the bubbles in this natural foam will typically burst very quickly and the foam will soon disappear. Something, you know, we've all have witnessed around on our feet on the beach, for example. Foam that lasts longer is a sign that there is something else in the water, specifically chemicals called surfactants. These compounds, which include common soap and many comparable industrial chemicals, make the bubbles last much longer. Long-lasting foam is a certain sign that the water is not pure. So this is a dead giveaway that you should not be sticking your head in this water and drinking all there is. And as we inspect the appearance of water and kind of deduce what's going on, another thing to in mind is the color, you know, which doesn't necessarily reflect the bottom nor the light reflected off the surface, but rather it gives away the particle composition of the water body. So for indigo blue to greenish blue water, that means low nutrient levels and low organic growth. The color here is primarily produced by the microscopic algae, or in other words, the phytoplankton. And what I'm looking at here is a table used by the Citizens Observatory for Coast and Ocean Optical Monitoring. Whoa. So this is a very organized piece of information here with the color pretty much put in a scale system. So on the low end of the scale is the color that I just mentioned. And supposedly, I guess you could say, equate that with a more of a higher quality of water as compared to the other end of the spectrum, which is brownish green to cola brown water. And I'm definitely ain't drinking that. And that's, you know, waters with an extremely high concentration of humic acids, which are typical for rivers and estuaries, actually. Especially once comes rainy season and you just got that first rain that kind of brings all of the sediment within the watershed into the river and just completely turning it brown, making the water rise, you know. So, and in between, all in between within the scale is, you know, like you find greenish blue to bluish green. This is a little bit on the lower end, you know, color that is still dominated by algae, but has an also increased dissolved matter and some sediment, which may be present. And this is typical for areas toward the open sea. And then we got greenish color, which, you know, is often coastal waters, which usually display increased nutrient and phytoplankton levels, but also contain minerals and dissolved organic material. Next is, you know, more greenish brown to brownish green, which signifies high nutrient and phytoplankton concentrations, but also increased sediment and dissolved organic matter, which is typical of near shore areas in tidal flats. So I guess I don't know if this would be an indication of water quality per se, just a matter of knowing what's in the water. So if you really want to know what's going on with the quality of the water, it all the signs are there with the fish, obviously. But surprisingly, they're more of the late markers. What I was surprised to learn was insects are a fantastic source of what's going on. So if there is a concern about what is coming out of a pipe that feeds into a river, you only need to take an interest in the aquatic insects and come to your own conclusions by, you know, noticing the different insects, you know, comparing the water upstream and below the pipe. And this way, the answer will be blatantly obvious. And man, this world of insects is, it's deep, let me tell you. But one special insect that is very good to know and to acquire a visual memory of is called the agapetus. And this insect reveals that the water body that it's around has not been polluted for one single day within the past year. Also, their presence is a sure sign that the water is dependable all year round and the spring is unlikely to dry up during the summer. And then you can look at other insects with longer life cycles, which indicate more of a timeline history for reference of, you know, the water body's purity and its flow from the past 2 or 3 years. And this is where the whole world gets pretty deep. But I, you know, it's a very well worth pursuit of study, which I myself will be diving in personally. So more to come in future episodes about possible insects and what they can reveal about your surroundings. Another one in particular worth mentioning, and perhaps even of a better indicator of water quality, is the stone clinger mayfly nymph. Oh boy, the first time pronouncing that name. But they had earned their name by its habitat of using the pressure of the water flow over its head to stick to rocks. So think about it. Anything that happens to the finest little intricate detail of that water, affecting that slight microscopic pressure, and they won't be able to live. You know what I'm saying? Very interesting rabbit hole to dive in. But so theoretically, all your pollutants that you want to know about, levels, so on, like nitrates, phosphates, oxygen levels, light levels, water speed, each individual pollutant, there will be clues to all of these. And not just at that moment, but for their levels over every second of the past year or more with this kind of knowledge. And one of the key characteristics of water is its surface tension. You know, if you pour yourself a glass, got a little tiny bit of a, say, needle, you know, say like a threaded needle, you know, you just lay that on the top there and it'll float naturally. Add a little bit of detergent into the mix and you'll notice it'll sink right to the bottom right away. Because this is the addition of detergent weakens the chemical bonds that are in the first place responsible for that surface tension. So without getting too deep into the science here, that's a sure sign that of something in the water. So with these insects, for example, that are most of them are able to live on the water with the surface tension and are very, very sensitive to that kind of stuff. If there is detergent or any kind of these additions, chemical pollutants in the water, you know, the insects won't be able to live anymore. And so that's why they are like an example of why they're a sure indicator of what's going on. And now beyond insects, you can take a peek in what's in the water or river or whatever, and note the water quality with signs from underneath. Like, for example, if you find crawfish or some kind of mollusk in that sense in a river, there's a very fine quality. It's a sure indicator that it's got high oxygen levels, which is a good thing. And so, you know, there's species you can look for within the water itself. And if you happen to see snails clinging to the surface film of the water, then that is a very likely sign that the water has warmed up a fraction and the oxygen levels have dropped to a level that is starting to thread all the life in the water. So that is another indicator there. I mean, basically, you're just witnessing a massacre of dying snails gasping for their very last breath. And fish are the same way. They need their oxygen too. Many experienced fishermen would tell you that the fish prefer poply water. That is, when the water of a stream gently mixes with the air. Here are the prime hangout locations for the fish. But remember that their needs are summed up in two things, shelter and food, for like trout, for example.
So if you could learn to see the river in terms of those two things from the trout's perspective, then you'll find the trout. And places that offer shelter in combination with water that isn't too fast, but also near enough water that is flowing and bringing a concentration of food past, will be prime real estate for the trout and guarantee their presence. And it's really interesting to think that if you really wanted to take a sneak peek into the pristine, undisturbed nature of an environment like this at a quiet stream, it's all about allowing the river to invite you in. So when you're walking up the river, you may put your hand on a duck while it's still sitting on its nest. And speaking of ducks, they can give you valuable clues as to how deep the water body actually is. For example, if you find a duck that is frantically looking like it's lost, then you're probably looking at a shoveler duck, which stirs up the waterbed, looking for food with its beak, which obviously means that this is quite shallow water. So now let's say that you want to cross this stream, that you've determined it's shallow enough, and you see some rocks and stones across it that you could probably walk across. But you're not sure whether how stable it is or if it's going to slip on you and you're going to fall, which happened to me several times. So the old saying here that the author points out in this is that a rolling stone gathers no moss. So the moss shows you the parts of the stream where the rocks are settled, and therefore good clues to where to place your feet when you're crossing. But then again, these moss spots are also slippery, so there's really no way to win. Well, there is, but you just gotta be a little slick, you know? Which can only come by crossing enough rivers and streams. So if you slip one day and the water is moving fast, then it's a good idea to point your legs downstream as soon as possible after tumbling, as the thing you want to avoid is your head hitting something. Because remember that the speed of water goes up by a factor of 2. So the size of an object it can carry goes up by 64. And note too that, you know, it's very normal for rivers, even the purest of rivers, to have a little bit of algae within them too, within the water. And this is normal, but when you see a sudden bloom, this is definitely a sign of warning or a sign of imbalance that something with lots of phosphates or nitrates in it has entered the water upstream, like fertilizer or effluent being one of the likely sources. But now let's step back for a moment and engage some of our other senses. So, you know, close your eyes and just listen a little bit more deeply and recognize the sounds that are characteristic of the area you're in. So if, let's say, like, you know that the stream is moving quite fast, and you'll hear characteristic sounds that accompany that usually, such as the American dipper, which is a small plump bird, gray all over but with white eyelids. And it's only found in or near water that is fast flowing. And this bird is native to the western United States. And it has a song, which is described as the pitch of which is high above the fundamental frequency of a fast-flowing stream, and a wonderful example of a song that has evolved alongside running water. Then at slower waters of lowland rivers, you'll find a different array of animals, which includes birds like coots, mute swans, gallinules, geese, cormorants, and as well as many dragonflies and damselflies. The water will give you a good clue as to the minerals in that water, and therefore in the land around. So, and crawfish, for example, need a lot of calcium to build up their shells, so they are a sign of chalk or limestone in the land. And this piece of knowledge, for example, will tell you that the heavy rains will not lead to flash floods. And another quick mention about water quality too. Forgot to mention that there's been a lost art from the old well streams that's called the blacktailing, which people will go and look at the color of the trout's tail as to indicate the lead pollution. And it was incredibly effective. And this was, you know, to spot where lead from disused mines were making its way into the water. But as I mentioned earlier, the quickest and surest way to note changes or sudden changes to the environment is to pay more attention to the insects, which react more quickly and sensitive to these changes. Salmon and trout are usually the last indicators of a change in a given water body. But now let's say that all of a sudden you wake up and you're in the middle of the desert and you're just dying of thirst and you're looking for water now. Now, what do we pay attention to, or what are some of the sure signs that will give us hope of an oasis nearby? Well, what I've read in this book is that if you see like flies, for example, and you're in the Sahara Desert, then that is golden treasure right there, because that usually means, or always means, that water is very close. Also be helpful, as they will often fly hundreds of yards in a straight line, that is, to and from water, forming a faint marker in the sky that points the way to it. So every wildflower, tree, and animal will be found with varying probabilities according to the amount of water in the local area you're in. So in this case, in the case of looking for water, insects and bugs are usually dead giveaways. But if you're really stranded and, man, you just have nowhere to look, I'd suggest looking up, because there, when you notice birds and what they're doing and knowing their relationship with water, then you could really figure out what's going on. And birds cover far more vast territory, because they don't have any sweat glands. So they lose water at a slower rate than many mammals. So, that means they could travel so much farther than most insects and mammals from water. But never deliberately beyond those ranges. So, it's important to note too, like the type of birds, predator birds or large birds that feed on carcasses, for example, like crows, get a lot of water from their food. So they don't need, water nearly as regularly as birds that feed on seeds, like pigeons, doves, chickens, swallows, and swifts, which usually need to visit water regularly when they are feeding. So it's important to pick up the clues from their behavior. So if you see birds that are flying fast and low, they are more likely heading toward water. But if they are flying from, perch to perch among the trees, this is a possible sign that they are full of water and are flying near the higher end of their weight range. And many birds have quite specific habitats too, like kingfishers are territorial river birds. So if you see one of those or another species bank swallowers, then, you're right on the money. Fresh water is right there. And then there are trees, which are also incredibly reliable to gauge what the water is like below and above ground and throughout the area. Because, when you think about it, just like with other plants too, they're rooted to the spot they're in. They're there for life. And so their presence is incredibly enlightening. And, the roots must achieve a very intricate and sensitive balance from the ground they will forever lie in. So they must support the tree and, perhaps against very strong winds, but also provide minerals and supply thousands of tons of water, because they're basically living pumps too. As with every other plant you see, from the tiniest bits of weeds to, the greatest oak tree, they all depend on what's called capillary action to get the water from the ground to its highest leaves. And also eventually into the atmosphere, seeding clouds and affecting weather patterns. So that's why when you plant more trees, or in areas with more trees, you get more rainfall. And thus it's a way of not only holding water that falls, but also generating water as well. And so all plants and trees kind of do this all in their own little way. So like beech trees, for example, have evolved to tolerate way low levels of water in the ground, whereas on the other side of the spectrum, willows and alders are the other types of trees that prefer consistently wet ground. So their roots are regularly wet, and which are a strong indicator that water is not too far away. So beech trees will show you dry areas, whereas these willows and alders will show you wetter areas. And man, the examples just go on and on and on. There's just a wealth of information out there. And with observation, consistent observation, the clues will just start revealing themselves one by one, and just knowing what to look for and knowing the characteristics of each thing you're looking at, it's just incredible. And this book, man, it was awesome. So, you know, I think this is a good stopping point of with these gems, at least, because I know I've promised to share a little quick story, very quick one, on the wisdom and the incredibility of navigators from the past. You know, we haven't talked much about the seas, because I assume that most of you listening to this right now are land-based and are not, you know, living life on the high seas. So, but it's interesting, this story nonetheless, to just show you the type of knowledge people carried with them thousands of years ago. So without further ado, this is just a quick excerpt from the book about Captain Abhara. So this dude began his working life as a shepherd in the Persian district of Kerman. A job on a fishing boat took him to sea, and this led to work as a sailor on one of the vessels that traded the route to India, before he hopped to plying the treacherous China sea lanes. At the time, it was felt that nobody ever made the journey to China and back without serious mishap. Abhara did it 7 times, and all of this took place toward the end of the first millennium. So how do we know this much about a man of lowly background from a distant part of the world all those years ago? Because he did something that displayed extraordinary knowledge and chutzpah, enough of which for the story to survive. Once, a sailor who also worked the feared route to China, Captain Shariyari, was waiting out a worrying calm in the midst of the typhoon season when he spotted a dark object on the distant sea. A small boat was lowered and 4 sailors were dispatched to investigate the mysterious speck. On reaching the dark object, they discovered a familiar face. The respected Captain Abhara was sitting calmly in a canoe with nothing but an animal skin full of water. When they returned and reported this surreal sight to Shariyari, he asked why this stricken and respected other captain had not been rescued and brought on board. The crew replied that they tried, but that Captain Hambara had refused to swap his small canoe to their greater vessel, claiming he would be fine on his own and would only join them if he was paid the substantial sum of 1,000 dinars, or dinars. Captain Shariyari and his crew mulled over this bizarre proposal, but with their estimate of Abhara's wisdom and their fear of the strange weather conditions that prevailed, the lull obviously causing them concern about what lay ahead, they agreed and lifted Abhara on board. Once on board his new ship, the canoeing captain wasted no time and demanded his 1,000 dinars, and he was duly paid. He then told Captain Shariyari and his crew to sit down, listen, and obey his orders. They did. Ardakal al Akbar, Captain Abhara shouted. Abhara explained to the captain and his crew that they were in great danger. They must throw their heavy cargo overboard, saw down their main mast, and throw that overboard too. Then they were to cut the cable for their main anchor and let the ship drift. The crew obeyed Abhara's orders and set to work. Although it can't have been easy, 3 things a sailing trader would prize above most others were his cargo, the mast, and the main anchor. These were their tangible icons of wealth, transport, and safety, the reason they had risked their lives and their means of preserving them. But they did as they were told, and then they waited. On the 3rd day, a cloud rose up until it appeared like a lighthouse before them, before it dissolved and crumbled back down into the sea again. And then the typhoon Alkab hit them. It raged for 3 days and nights. The new lightness of the ship allowed it to bob over waves and reefs like a cork, and they were saved instead of swamped, smashed, and drowned. On the 4th day, the wind died down and the crew were able to make their way safely to their destination in China. On the way back from China, the ship now freshly loaded with a new cargo, Captain Abhara ordered the vessel to stop. The dinghy was lowered and some sailors were sent to find and retrieve the great anchor they had cut loose before the storm and left on the reef. The crew were stunned and asked Captain Abhara how he had known where to look for the anchor and how he had forecast the typhoon so accurately. He explained that knowledge of the moon, the tides, the winds, and the signs in the water made it all perfectly straightforward. If you enjoy this episode, please rate it and leave a comment, and also just reach out and introduce yourself to ecovillagelibrary@gmail.com. Until next time, much love.